Okay, I want to put on our radar that we're not there quite yet, but we're going to get to talk about curates. We're going to get to talk about divine excision. I was just preparing future classes, and I looked ahead and I saw there's a lot of fascinating agadic material that comes up. This part, I mean, I'll admit it's more on the drier side. But again, I think just so we understand the Rabban's philosophy of Gehenna and how that works, rather than jump around from place to place and lose background information that's important, it's significant that the Rabban is building up an entire thesis of the afterlife. So he makes references back to what he talked about previously, and it's important that we try to get the full picture. So we're going to try to move a little bit more expeditiously through this section, but I don't want to downplay it either because this is also very interesting. We're going to continue talking about the nature of the fires of hell, but also we're going to talk about the nature of the human soul too. We're going to continue that. Can you see the screen share?
Yes.
All right. So, Ukvari Iskarti, I mentioned previously, he makes reference back to what we learned before. Masha Rabbi Seinu Zichron Levracha Echad Miishi Makom Ha'Onesh Hazeh Shunahar Shel Ish HaYotze Mitaches Kisei HaKavod. So where does the flame originate from? The flame originates from God's holy throne. Hare Shemalim, let's flip the page. Whenever I go on screen share, it does this. Moment. There we go. Hare Shemalim Da Kuso HaKisei HaKavod Shuyisod Kol Nivra Fapnini Mikula. So the Ramban says that the throne of God, the Kisei HaKavod, is the source of all creation. That is where creation extends from. And the flames of Gehenna come forth from that source of creation. We mentioned previously that since the fires of hell are metaphysical in nature, that was the word I was looking for this whole time. I kept using the word spiritual, I meant metaphysical. Since the fires are metaphysical in nature, therefore they come from the Kisei HaKavod. They don't come from primordial matter. Primordial matter God used to create the elements from which God created the world, but this fire is something else entirely. It says in Yeshayahu about this flame, Nishmas Hashem Kinacho Gofres Baraba. So it comes from the neshima, like a breath or the spirit of God. Hanefesh nishmas chaim. Like what it says that God breathed into Adam life. Like we mentioned before. So like we mentioned before, when we talk about the spirit, when we talk about ruach in this context, ruach does not mean wind, literally, but ruach means spirit, according to the Ramban. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, maskim bebrias yom sheni, on the second day of creation, harakia al rashi achayas ha-malachim ve'ishu shel gehenna. The angels and the flames of hell were created together. Now, this is going to be interesting. We're going to see soon that it's not that on the second day of creation, God created angels. Oh, and by the way, he also created the fires of Gehenna. We're going to see in a moment that the fires of Gehenna and angels may, in some circumstances, be one and the same thing, the same entity. It says in the Gemara Chagiga Gimel and Beis, Gabe Nahar Dinor, when it comes to this river, Nahar Dinor, Mehecha Shakel, Mizias and this river, which leads down to hell, it burns the those transgressors that are there. Where does it originate? It originates from literally the perspiration of the angels called Chayos. It's a bit of a weird phrase. What's that mean? It comes from their perspiration. So either one, according to Ramban, that's literally where it comes from. But according to Yesharim talks about this. He says, it's because angels, even though they don't have the same challenges as men, there is this idea that angels, to a certain degree, could mess up. They could accidentally not follow God's orders. So out of their great fear of straying from God's ways, they're constantly perspiring, and that perspiration actually is a source for that river which punishes those who are in Gehenna. But Heichan, also, where does this river go? Shafich al rosh rishayim v'gehenna. It gets poured onto the heads of the wicked who are found in Gehenna. V'amar pirkei halichos, Echelos to Rabbi Yishmael. So in Echelos it says, Shenishba kodesh baruch hu al oso rasha lofnius kesar. That God says about this Russia, this wicked man named Lofinos Caesar, one of the Caesars, Shaharag Asar Hurechim Malchus. So, does anyone know when we say the Asar Hurechim Malchus, the 10 martyrs?
Anyone know? Kippur.
Yom Kippur, right. But we didn't say this Yom Kippur. We admitted that. But of course, it's still in your Machzarim. But this past Yom Kippur, while we were cutting out things from Chazar Sashatz, from the Chazan's repetition of Shmona Esrei, Asura Haruge Malchus was one of the things that didn't make the cut. So Asura Haruge Malchus, this Lofinus Kesar was responsible for killing them. Shuhu, obviously there's a whole debate historically about the Asura Malchus, the historicity of it. But anyway, that's what Ramban is saying. Shumat imo tam or v'gachle ish, kruvim v'ofad v'chayos ha-kodesh, v'sorfin l'osa rasha v'gehenem. So these angels are appointed to give him all the different kinds of suffering and punishment that he could get in Gehenem. Bereishis Rabbah, so this is going to be two interpretations of a pasuk in Bereishis, in Genesis. The pasuk says, v'yishkan mikedem l'gan Eden. So it's a little unclear what it means by mikedem. They dwelled, mikedem, we'll translate what that means, ligan Eden, the Garden of Eden. So they dwelled from before the Garden of Eden. That's how I'd literally translate it. The rest of the verse is, esakruvim veselahat cherev hamisapeches. And the angels called kruvim, they had these flaming, turning swords to guard the Garden of Eden once Adam and Eve were exiled from there. So how do we understand, how do we make sense of this verse? There are two interpretations. Dover acher, mikedem koden legan Eden nivru. It's telling us that the angels were created before the Garden of Eden was created. Shnemar, as it says in Ezekiel and Yecheskel, and it's supported by a verse in Yecheskel, which talks about the angels of Kruvim that were found there. What does it mean, the flaming sword that the angels held? Like it says in Tehillim, that those who serve him, those who serve God, they have this this burning flame. Hamisapeches, what does it mean that it turns? Shehem misamchin pamim anashim, pamim nashim, pamim ruchos, pamim malachim. That angels are shapeshifters. They can take the form of a man. Sometimes to fulfill their mission, they take the form of a woman. Sometimes forces of nature, ruchos, winds, pamim malachim, and sometimes they take the form of an angel itself. Whatever it looks like in its original form. You look in Sefer Yecheskel, it talks about that. So one interpretation of the pasuk is telling us that angels were created before the Garden of Eden. That's interpretation number one. Interpretation number two, Dover Acher, Mikedem, Kodem Legan Eden, Nivris Gehenem. Not that the angels were created before Gehenem, but not before Gan Eden, but Gehenem was created before the Garden of Eden. Gehenna Nivritz Bashani, Gan Eden Bashlishi, because Gehenna was created on the second day, Gan Eden was created on the third day. Vetzahat HaCherev, what does it mean, this burning sword? Al Shem Vlahano Samhayom Haba, that though in the future days, in the end of days, the wicked will be punished and a great flame will be brought upon them. So according to these two interpretations, Ramban says, so angels and Gehenna are both created before Gan Eden. What's the significance of that? It's to tell us that they're actually, what is the source of the flames of Gehenna? The source is from the angels. The angels perspire. The angels create the flame, and it's the angels who are running the show. So they produce the fires of Gehenna, which makes sense because, like we said, angels have this capability that they're able to take on different forms. So it's within their prowess, apparently, that they're able to create flames to punish the wicked who are in Gehenna. Okay. So you can add that to their character sheet in Dungeons and Dragons now. Ish ruchnis kenegen nefesh ruchnis. So we're going to answer a question we had before. We had a question about how is it possible that souls could burn in hell? We kind of answered this already, but this is the end of that whole of this whole arichus, this whole tangent. God created a fire that has not that has no connection to the body. So refis tvarim dagashin aguf mechalism, it only burns metaphysical entities. Shina chashal akar shiyodah b'briyas nevesh b'ritzon yisbar, shalei esh lahamzi devar dak mo munach kenegda l'chalosa. It makes sense. If God could create a soul, God could create an entity that could destroy a soul. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh, right? So it works in all principles of creation. Also, it's not just human beings that burn in this river of fire that we alluded to before. But also it says in Shmos Rabbah, in the Medrash, the Malachim Atzmom Shnisrafim Benahar Dinar, that the angels themselves actually burn in that fire. Esh Ochelet Esh, fire consumes fire. What does that mean? So if we look here in the Perush, the Medrash tells us, angels become renewed every day and they praise God. So what that means is that angels at the end of their day, so right when they clock out at the end of their shift, God puts them back into a river, and when they go into that river, they get consumed. And then the next day, God recreates them again in order to perform whatever responsibility they have. And this is just something important to understand how angels work. Angels get sent on specific missions. And so they could take the form of different people. When they visited Abraham Avinu, when they visited Abraham after he had his bris, so they took the form of men. But they could also take the form, for instance, when Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the burning bush, it's not God himself that was there, but God used an angel to create a sort of a connection. So it was an angel that was in the bush there. So angels could take on all sorts of different forms to perform God's will in this world. Now, if you're going to ask, how could a nefesh, how could a soul be found inside the netherworld, inside of Gehenna? I can give you the answers that you'll find. You'll find some answers from Greek philosophers, from those who we disagree with. They say the soul is not found in a physical place. If you open up someone's brain, you open up someone's heart, you're not going to find the soul over there. When we talk about the brain and we talk about the soul, they say, we're actually just using it as a mashal. We're using it as a parable to refer to the soul. So, but the soul, though, is a very, ambiguous term, ambiguous in its own nature. Soul, for instance, it's not just used to mean the life force of someone, but it's used to mean like the attitude, the feeling, the disposition of somebody. It's like when they say we fight for the soul of this nation, it doesn't literally mean our life force that's in our bodies. It's an expression. So that's how some of the philosophers see it. However, according to Ramban, our souls actually are real entities that can be found in a certain place. He argues in the next paragraph, "Vanachim kol zeh lo nasi sichlin shlei beguf ruvin zeh min abiri adaka zunikris nefesh." Certainly, we have an actual entity called a soul that resides within our bodies. More so than the soul that you're going to find in an animal, in the brain of a donkey, or you're going to find in a tree. Shlotian nefashe begufi nitzmes nafshi begufi nitzmes yoser mash nafshi nitzmes begufa shoponi chaverai. And you're not going to find either that obviously my soul needs to be more attached to me than it's attached to my friend's soul, because otherwise, what distinguishes me from the next person? Zerban admits that there's a little bit of ambiguity himself. He says, well, if the soul isn't physical, but it resides in my body, what does that actually mean? Because you can't open up someone's body and find the soul. So if the soul is somewhere in me, where exactly am I going to find that? So even Rabban realizes that there's a certain level of difficulty over here. Yechabura begufi. So there's different ways to address this. One is there's basically a theory. I don't really study Hasidus, but this is a popular notion for those who study Tanya and other Hasidic works. There's something called a Nefesh HaBahamas, which is there are two kinds of souls that we have. There is more of the general animalistic soul, and then there is the more human, higher-level soul that we have. And the idea is that this Nefesh HaBahamas, this more rudimentary spirit, this more rudimentary soul, serves as the chibur. It serves as the conduit to connect our physical bodies to our actual souls, which is the higher level, and it creates a bond between the physical and metaphysical. So you have this ruchnis amir burachayim, this full spiritual soul. The etzla nefesh acheris ba'adam. V'nitzvu shtei nefashos daka kemes begasim mena bala hatnua nitzmeches b'chom ha'teva v'dam. You have this more general life force, which can be found in our blood, which is more of a lower level of metaphysicality. That's made shtei ka kesher ashal heves of psila im hashemen. And you can see it almost as, imagine you have a flame, and you have a wick, and you have the oil. So to create a connection between the oil and the flame, you need a wick in between to hold the flame, but also absorb the oil. So this lower form of our neshama, this lower level soul, connects our higher level soul to our body, he says. So we're not going to get too much into it right now. But we're moving through just to understand his general conception of the soul. So therefore, Ava Akopanim, Misha Shachin Osab Bechomer Azev Hitzmid Beina Ubein Haguf, Yogel Hagvil Osab Makom Ahum. You're able to stay in, it keeps your soul in one place. Lechar Beina Ubein Eisha Dakash of Osu Hamakom Shumin Hakasal Yona, Benivra Alza Inya Shetichla Hanefesh, Betishtana Ben Mitzrafahu Ol Kilion Hacharutz. And therefore, the soul, when it goes down into Gehenna, either there's two possibilities. Either it becomes purified, b'mitzrafahu, or the second purpose why someone's soul goes down to Gehenna is kilyon, it's to be destroyed utterly. And we mentioned this before. We said that there are different levels of hell, and there's the final level called Arka. So people who are exceedingly wicked, they go down to Arka Lidori Doros. And the idea is that their soul becomes completely destroyed there and never rises from that state. We'll talk about, God willing, in the next class, if that's really true. Does the human soul actually cease to exist, or does it stay in Gehenna for all eternity? Anyway, the next part is really the Rambam. But I think, you know, we'll skip over it a little bit. I'll just summarize it outside just so we could cover ground. So you don't see this so often, but I just want to point this out. He quotes from the Mor Nevuchim. He quotes Rambam over here. usually we rely on the Parish. We rely on the commentary to tell us when Rambam is commenting, but the Ramban lived after the Rambam. So many times you'll see the Ramban quote, not many times, but you'll see every now and then, the Ramban will quote the Rambam in his commentary on the Torah as well. One more classic example is the whole story. We talked about Avraham Avinu before. So how Avraham, he had the whole entire story with Sodom and Amorah and Lot escaping, that whole entire narrative, according to Rambam, was all in a dream. It was all some sort of message or nevuah that God was giving to him. But it's a really crazy Rambam. Essentially, a lot of the narratives that we see in the Torah, the narratives with Sodom and Amorah, Rambam says, yeah, you know what? Those never happened. Those were all just a dream that Avram was having. You know, it's like in a movie where something really crazy happens, the character looks like they're about to die, and then they wake up in a cold sweat. Oh, it's just a dream. So that's how Rambam understands some of the narratives in the Torah, because he says that it was a nevuah that he had to have. So if he had a nevuah, if he was communicating with God, it was through nevuah, and nevuah happens when someone is asleep. So that's that you could imagine. I mean, I don't know. Is anyone taken aback by that explanation? I personally would be. If someone told me that, receiving the Torah was just a made-up story, I would be pretty upset about that, right? Because that's what my religion's based on. So obviously it's not to the same extent, but you could imagine that anyone with traditional sensitivities doesn't like to hear someone say, by the way, that story in Tanakh never happened. It's just parable. It's made up. So anyway, why do I bring that up? Because there are instances where Rambam will quote Rambam in order to disagree with him. But over here, he's actually going to quote the Rambam as support. You don't see that as frequently. So Rambam says that Rambam Mor Avuchim tells us that there is this more general soul which helps you move around, but your more spiritual soul, that's what's used to impose your will. So there's this Nefesh HaBahamas, this animalistic soul, which gives you the ability to move around. It gives you the ability to perform physical activities, but that animalistic soul has no power if your actual soul, which is your will, doesn't will it to move. So they're basically totally about Zebizeh. They're contingent on one another. Okay. But then he says, moving forward in the Ramban, Ukvar amru oktas misichlehem, ein bal chomer yochel ha-sik ha-sagar shleim al-ezit tzad ha-yeh ha-nifrat tziba v'tzisa bal chomer. These are things that we can never truly, fully understand. Nonetheless, even if we can't fully understand the nature of the soul, the point is, humans have a soul. Souls help us move around. They're our life force. And if we sin, they go to hell. If we perform enough mitzvos, they go to the world to come, to Gan Eden. Great. So that's what he says in the next paragraph over here. So we can skip over that. Okay. V'anachnu al kabbalah amitis me'avos hakadoshim. We've accepted in our tradition. Shlosh kifu b'yal de nachrim. We don't look into what the non-Jewish philosophers have said to lead people astray. Ma'alo samadakim in yonah me'ila ala harbe. Asha omar abasin yuzchon avracha. Ki ilu daitam nota shalo nivras. So what does that mean? Our rabbis say that the soul is regarded as if it is never created. What does that mean, that it was never created? Amaru, the veracious rabbi, it says in the Medrash of our rabbis, Am ha-melech m'malachto yeshu sham. That's what it says in Divrei Hayamim. Sorry, Im ha-melech m'malachto yeshu sham. So with the king and his kingship, they dwell there. Im melech malchim lochem kodesh baruch hu, yeshu nashu osim shel tzadikim. Because with God dwells the souls of the righteous. Shebehen nimlach ubare haolam. because it was with them that God created the world. Ukviyachol shalakash baruchu also mahu daita v'natol etzem mehen v'az bara es olam. So this is fascinating. You may have heard this idea from the rabbis that God, before he created the world, he said, he talked to the angels, and then he said, let us create the world. Let us create creation. So this is saying that God didn't only consult the angels, but God was surrounded by the souls of the righteous. Now, how are they the souls of the righteous if they haven't yet performed righteous deeds? I'm a little unclear on that, because I would think any soul has a clean slate before it's put on this world. But nonetheless, God consulted the souls of the righteous, and that from there he created the world. So even Ramban says that not everyone fully understands the meaning of this passage from the rabbis. But we can derive from this. The rabbis put the soul on a much higher level than what the world philosophers believe. Ramban likes to criticize also, when you look at a lot of theological, philosophical works, they wax poetic, they use all sorts of fancy language with many syllables, they're verbose, and Ramban, you'll see a few times, I don't really spend time on it, but he criticizes the philosophers for making things more complicated than they have to be, which is, you know, it's kind of good to hear from Ramban that I'm not the only one who feels this way sometimes, that, you know, we don't have to make things more complicated than they have to be. I remember I was told by my Rebbe in Shalavim, which is my gap year program. So he had a friend who also was a Talmud Chacham. He was also a scholar. And he went to interview at a seminary, to teach at a seminary in Israel. So he came in with flow charts and tables, and he organized, he took what was a really complicated sugya, and he laid it out step by step in such a flawless and seamless manner that what happened at the end was that people came over to him. They said, yeah, you know, the girls, they followed the shir so well, you know, we think we can use someone who like has a little bit more substance, a little bit more content to his classes. We think that'd be a better fit for our seminary. So then after some persuasion, this gentleman got the dean of the seminary to give him one more model lesson. And this model lesson, instead of taking all the material and organizing it in a way that the goal was for the students to clearly and easily understand the flow of the topic, the flow of the sugya, instead, he gave out all the makoros, he went through them, he jumped back and forth so that there was no clear order, and it was like a huge mishmash of sources. The girls came out of the class, they were scratching their heads, trying to like make sense. They were talking about trying to make sense and put into order what happened, and he got the job. Not because, and the content, he said, the level of the content that he shared in that second model lesson was the same amount of sources, essentially the same kind of level of difficulty of content, but he just didn't put in all the work to organize it seamlessly and to make it easily digestible. So people walked out of class thinking that, oh wow, you know, I'm really learning Torah on a high level because I don't understand anything that was just said to me. So that's like a big mistake that people make, which is, just because it's hard for you to understand doesn't mean that it's on a higher level than someone else. So there's books out there today by Rav Rimon, Rav Melamed. They take complicated areas of halacha and they just have a knack for making flow charts, for collecting all the sources and putting it into summaries and bullet points. It's the same source you get from anyone else. But the point is that when we talk about, there is an idea of being osik b'torva, gisa b'yom v'lay, you're supposed to actually push yourself. You're supposed to have difficulty in learning, but the difficulty is not supposed to be understanding the basics. You shouldn't make things, we're not supposed to make things more complicated than they have to be. I'll give another example. I think, you know, when kids grow up in day schools, so part of what's difficult for them when they're learning Jewish texts and learning Gemara is that most of their time is dedicated to vocabulary. It's dedicated to translation. And when we talk about how you're supposed to dedicate yourself and Torah is supposed to be a challenge, it doesn't mean that Chazal didn't have in mind that you're going to be spending all day writing vocab sheets and going over vocabulary sheets. Their idea was that you'll be thinking of different svaros, different halachic sugyos, and weighing the merits of them. But, you know, obviously, I think when the rabbis were writing in Aramaic, they just assumed whoever was reading it knew how to read Aramaic. That wasn't actually in their cheshbon. Anyway, I'm going a little bit off track, I realize, but I wanted to share that because Ramban, in a few times in this section, has and will critique the Greek philosophers for making these kind of topics more complicated, for obfuscating them, and making it, more ambiguous than it actually needs to be. So his goal, really, is to just give us the bullet points. Even though Ramban is a little bit verbose himself, he's much better than when you look in works like Mor Nevuchim and you look in other philosophical works. Okay. Let's move a little. Were there any questions, by the way? I haven't paused for a while. So I just want to pause if there are any thoughts or questions. Okay. Moving forward. So what do our rabbis believe when it comes to the punishment that a soul endures? God wills the flames of Gehenna. Okay, great. Did we just... Oh, we've reached the end of this sheet. So, Yashar Koa, this is a good accomplishment. I know, again, I appreciate you all bearing with me. This was running through material just so we could keep things consistent and get the full picture. What we learned today is the nature of the human soul. The human soul is able to be burned in hell. The human soul is our life force, the nature of it, where it's going to be found, the connection, different kinds of souls. Ramban touches on a bit. Next time we get together, we are going to start a section on kares, on divine excision. It's come up so many times. And actually, I think the reason... maybe it was Toby and Phyllis who wanted me to move on a little further inside Shaar Gemul, was to address questions like, what is the mean that the soul gets cut off? What does it mean? Does it cease to exist? Is it a different kind of punishment? So God willing, we've just reached a section that's Kares Ugehenem. We're going to talk about the nature of Kares, and there's a lot of the material starts to liven up again a little bit in this section. So God willing, we will continue. It looks like... Yeah, next Thursday, we should be good. Is it Hoshana Rab? No, Hoshana Rab is Friday.
Okay. Friday.
Good. So, no change in my schedule. I'm here for Chol HaMoed. And even if I wasn't, I guess we're on Zoom anyway. So, we'll continue next time. Were there any questions or thoughts, anything about the Shiur before we conclude for today? Okay, great. So, Thank you. Looking forward. And as far as Monday night classes, that should still be on. So,
right. See
you all then. Have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and God willing, see you over Sukkot.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi. Good holiday to you and the family.
Thanks. You as well.
Thank you.